From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The governor, Roy Cooper, and the Republican-led General Assembly have been waging a political turf war in North Carolina. We'll chat with one expert to learn what the state constitution has to say about that series of battles. North Carolina's junior U.S. senator has concerns about the way the military replaces basic weapons, even simple handguns. You'll learn why. Some state lawmakers want to ensure that the University of North Carolina is prepared for the types of large-scale violence seen on other college campuses across the country. You'll hear their remarks. Plus, you'll learn why something called mens rea is an important protection for innocent people in North Carolina, and you'll learn why it needs to be strengthened. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
U.S. House Speaker Paul Ryan and Republican congressional leaders have now released the first component of their plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. Among those analysts poring over the details is the John Locke Foundation's healthcare expert, Catherine Restrepo. For months now, Catherine has been writing about the principles that a repeal and replacement plan should be based on. She's here now to tell us if the new document from House Republicans does any of that at all. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Your principles have always been consumer choice, more competition,
yes,
free up the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a grade on this plan from Paul Ryan.
Yeah. Overall, it's Obamacare light. I mean, there's still key provisions in Obamacare today as there would be under this new so-called repeal and replace plan. Overall, I'd probably give it a C. Yeah,
let's talk
average.
Well, there's a little bit of good news.
Yeah,
and some
there's,
bad
there's
news
good
in
and
this
bad.
Plan.
It has to be politically feasible, and there is a divide amongst the Republicans. So we can talk about that too.
Let's talk about some of the major components that most people are familiar with in terms of Obamacare. So
mm-hmm.
let's compare Obamacare
sure.
with what the plan is. First of all, the mandate right now under Obamacare is that every person must purchase government-approved health insurance or pay a penalty.
Right. Yes, under Obamacare you do. But under this plan, the American Health Care Act, you would not. There would be no penalty.
So that's
there would
a good,
be no tax
that's progress.
Penalty. Yes, that's progress.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about pre-existing conditions? Everybody's concerned about that. What if you're sick and then you have to get new health
mm-hmm.
insurance? Under Obamacare, you cannot be excluded for a pre-existing condition.
Right. And under this plan, you still cannot be excluded. However, there is potential where this could be sort of figured out in a more innovative way. People with pre-existing conditions would be sorted out or taken out of the individual health insurance market and they could get coverage plans through a high risk pool that's federally funded. So that's what in the law it's called more innovative risk pools or innovative funding for states to use at on their own. And this, in a way, allows the rest of the market, the individual market, to be for insurance companies to be innovative or offer more catastrophic plans or different types of healthcare plans that are more affordable for more people, because you won't have those high risk enrollees in the individual market. They will be in a separate pool where they'll have subsidized plans for themselves.
It sounds like there's a little bit more choice there.
Yes. Yes, there is.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And especially with the fact that insurance companies under this new plan compared to Obamacare, the way they price their premiums based on your age. Right now under Obamacare, an older person, their premium can't be more than 3 times the amount of a younger person. So what that ends up happening is that younger people are paying more for older people's premiums to offset the cost. So their premiums aren't super high. So with the new plan, that would be more flexible for insurance companies. It could go back to a 5-to-1 rating ratio.
Now, speaking of younger people, one provision of Obamacare is that folks who are up to 26 years old could continue to be on their parents' insurance plan.
Mm-hmm.
What about the Paul Ryan proposal?
Mm-hmm. That keeps that intact as well.
So a lot of people are going to like those things. So a few good things in there for folks who want more competition and choice.
Yes.
But still some other things that,
mm-hmm.
Fair to say, you're kind of
a little tentative. I mean, especially when you look at why healthcare costs are so high the way they are. I mean, does it really solve the problem of the way the healthcare system is structured now? I mean, when you look at this reconciliation bill, this repeal bill, on it really it makes changes to the way people supply healthcare, insurance companies, hospitals. I mean, how on more of a macro level. But what I'm waiting for is for the next bill that will be a part of this process, the entire repeal and replace process, that really looks at more patient reform aspects, where you can, I mean, under the current bill, you have people can contribute more into their health savings account. That's a bedrock of consumer driven healthcare, more consumer control, patient control over their healthcare decisions. But I'm looking for more of that in the following component that comes along.
Now, right now, we're also familiar with the word subsidy when it comes to Obamacare, and some people are given subsidies based on a sliding scale of their income in order to purchase health insurance through Obamacare. What does the Paul Ryan plan do? Are there subsidies?
There are subsidies, and it would be in the form of refundable tax credits. So it's a subsidy because it's not a subsidy under Obamacare that goes directly to the insurance company. And depending on your income, you can receive a subsidy, which will offset the cost of your health plan. Under this plan, the good thing about these refundable tax credits is that it's in the hands directly of the consumer. So they can take that with them. They can shop around for plans. They know how much they're getting to use to offset the cost of health insurance. However, the amounts, and they're tied to age rather than well, they're more so tied to age. So if you're 30, you will get $2,000 tax credit, regardless of your income. It starts to fade your depending on your income, these tax credit amounts phase out. But if you're making up to $75,000 and you're 30 years old, you can receive a $2,000 tax credit to purchase health insurance. So I take issue with that. I mean, we should not be subsidizing people who do not need subsidies to purchase health insurance.
Is that your biggest concern with this at this point? And keeping in mind, we know that this is a multi-step process, and we've only seen the first component of the whole process of repealing and replacing. But it sounds like you have some fundamental issues with this.
Right. And I think that goes back to I mean, I like the idea, the simplicity of the age-based tax credit, but it still leaves people out. I mean, you can be low income, 30 years old, receiving $2,000. Say you have a lot of health issues. I mean, that $2,000, that's, I mean, what is that? I mean, it depends on the regulations on the insurance side of things. And as we all know, regulations drive up the cost of premium. So that really all depends. So they have to go. There's all these moving parts that have to work together. I really think that, you know, at the bottom, at the end of the day, you have to think about how can we improve access to healthcare. And that means that patients need to be in control over their healthcare spending, because patients right now aren't the true customers of healthcare. In reality, insurance companies are, because they're the ones buying products and services from hospitals and other medical device companies, other suppliers, for that policyholder, for their benefits package.
So, I don't know what anything costs when I go to the doctor.
Yeah, unless, you know, it's a copay or your coinsurance, you know, you have to pay X percentage of what this bill is to see a specialist, or if you get a procedure done, if you're on Medicare even. But there has to be more price transparency and larger health savings accounts, in my opinion, for there to be an actual competitive market for people to make choices themselves.
Because how can we even try to be consumers of a product? I mean, if you go into a grocery store and you take a look at the meat counter, you can decide, do you want the cheaper hamburger or do you want to buy a really expensive steak? And you get to make the choice, and the prices are right there.
Yep.
So what do you do? Healthcare isn't that way.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing that sort of is ignored in this repeal and replace proposal is that the employer-sponsored health insurance is not reformed in any way. I mean, for years, ever since World War II, employers have been offering their workers tax-free healthcare benefits. So there's a distortion in the market to that compared to someone who doesn't have employer-sponsored health insurance. And that's another reason why there's lack of transparency in healthcare, because as an employee here, I mean, I don't know what my health insurance premium is. I don't know how much things cost unless it's a copay. But In reality, I really don't know what the true cost of healthcare is. And if you had larger health savings accounts where employers can contribute more for their employees if they want, there's more choice involved in a more robust market.
We've been talking with Catherine Restrepo about this latest proposal from U.S. House Speaker Paul Ryan and other congressional leaders. You can read all of Catherine's work, of course, at johnlock.org. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina government has seen a recent flurry of activity linked to the state constitution and the separation of powers among the governor, the General Assembly, and the courts. One of the people who has watched these issues with great interest is John Dinan, professor in the Department of Politics and International Affairs at Wake Forest University. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
So I would imagine that before 2017, not that many people in North Carolina were really paying a whole lot of attention to the Constitution and what it says about who controls what, who has the most power in state government. But this has really been in the headlines day after day after day this year, hasn't it?
I mean, I often, when I go to talk to groups, particularly about state constitutions, and I ask the members of the groups, how many of you had a chance to look at your state constitution, read your state constitution? Not surprising, this number is usually pretty low. But I'm gathering that as I ask that question in 2017, there's going to be some numbers, some more hands that are going to be raised in the audience of people who are going to have a reason to look at their state constitution, precisely because we now have a Republican-controlled legislature and a Democratic-controlled governor, and those things are just set up for conflicts, and many of those conflicts will be based on constitutional principles and will oftentimes be resolved in courts that have to interpret constitutional provisions.
Now, for those who haven't really followed this closely or don't remember much from their civics classes, the Constitution really does spell out, doesn't it, who controls what and who has the most power?
Yeah. I mean, we're most of us are very familiar with the U.S. Constitution. We've seen the general pattern of it. And state constitutions really follow in some ways the main provisions of the U.S. Constitution, in that there's a Bill of Rights. There are provisions setting out the here's who how you elect the legislature, here's how long the governor serves, here's how long the Supreme Court justices serve. And then there's a few policy provisions. That's the one thing that's a little bit different from state constitutions to the federal constitution. The federal constitution is very few so-called policy provisions, and you find a few more of those in state constitutions. Not so many in the North Carolina Constitution as you would say in California or Colorado, some of these others. But other than that, though, state constitutions serve some of the same purposes as the federal constitution does of organizing the government, limiting power, and securing rights.
Throughout the history of this state, when you look at the legislature versus the governor versus the courts, for years and years and years, the legislature really has been the dominant branch, hasn't it, in North Carolina?
Yeah. And there's various indications of that. One is for the first half century, the legislature selected the governor, and that was not unusual for American states, but it wasn't until the 1830s that actually the governor was independently elected by the people. The other thing, and this is the most striking thing, the North Carolina governor did not have the power to veto legislation until 1996 is when that was granted. That was a number of decades after every single other state in the country had granted their governor the veto power. That means the North Carolina governor for the last 20 years only has exercised the veto power and still lacks what is known as the line item veto power. That is the ability to veto particular items in bills. North Carolina is one of only six states that deprives its governor of that power. I could go on and provide other examples. But these are just illustrations of the way in which the legislature has clearly been the dominant branch in North Carolina that's set out in the Constitution, and that's illustrated in a number of ways.
We are speaking with Professor John Dinan of Wake Forest University. Fast forwarding now to the present, it looks as if after the election of Roy Cooper as governor in November, many members of the General Assembly and their top advisors took a look at the state constitution to see if there were ways that they could get the legislature even more power in this battle between the two branches. Is that right?
That is right. And there's one that got a lot of high-profile attention but never came to fruition, and that is the North Carolina Constitution does not set a fixed number of Supreme Court justices. It just so happens that there's 7 Supreme Court justices now, but actually the state constitution is quite explicit that if the legislature so chooses, it could raise that number to as much as 9. And so in the immediate aftermath of the November 2016 election, so there was some discussion about whether or not the North Carolina legislature would exercise its constitutional power. It ultimately decided not to do that, but it did take a number of other steps in a December 2016 special session. Those included, in one case, exercising powers that had always been in the state constitution but had laid dormant. And the leading example of that is the North Carolina state constitution is quite explicit that the governor shall, with the advising consent of the Senate, make appointments unless these appointments are already provided for in the constitution. That's for the Secretary of State, the various kind of council state offices. And that had not actually been exercised by previous legislatures, and the legislature in December 2016 said, we're going to start exercising that power and going to start requiring that the governor shall receive the advising consent of his cabinet appointments.
As we're speaking, that whole issue of the cabinet appointments is still in flux, The courts have not ruled on this. But this is going to be an interesting debate about whether the Constitution, as it's written, will end up holding firm and winning out in the final determination of things, or whether Roy Cooper can win the day by saying, look, this has never happened before. This would be such a departure from our past that this is just political gamesmanship and the court should throw it out.
There are several different types of matters that are going to be coming before the courts. There is, on the one hand, this matter concerning Senate confirmation of gubernatorial cabinet appointments. That is about as clear as one gets in terms of constitutional text, as that is permitting that to be done. There are, though, some other conflicts, at least 2 other conflicts. One is concerning the relative powers of the superintendent of schools versus the State Board of Education, and then a second conflict concerning how many people will there be on the state and local election boards, and will the governor's party still have the advantage, as his party has always had the advantage in the past, or will there be an even distribution of 4 members on the state election board of the governor's party and 4 of the party out of power. Those other measures, that is concerning the composition of election boards and concerning the state superintendent's power relative to the state election board, those are not explicit in the Constitution. Put another way, there's a lot of interpretation that can be offered about exactly what is the power of the governor here, what is the power of the legislature. That would be distinguished, though, from the case concerning the ability of the Senate to require confirmation of gubernatorial cabinet appointments, which is quite explicit in the text of the Constitution that that's permitted. That would be distinguished from some of the other cases where one can have arguments on both sides. And all this comes down to take things to kind of the next point, is that how should we interpret a state Supreme Court decision issued in January of 2016, the McCrory v. Berger decision, and aptly named. It's not quite a Bush v. Gore type of name, but it's about as close as we get in North Carolina, McCrory v. Berger, which involved a particular case of could the legislature set up a commission, an executive commission, and then could they appoint a majority of the members of that commission. And this was not explicitly resolved by the Constitution, but by a decision by the North Carolina Supreme Court with only 1 dissenting justice, the court decided that the background principles of separation of powers gave enough ability to the governor that he must be able to carry out executive duties. And in this particular respect, the legislature had taken away and transgressed on the governor's executive power. What we're going to see in a number of cases in 2017 is how to interpret those provisions that were given in McCrory v. Berger, the January 2016 decision, to these other cases. A lot will rest on how the court reads that 2016 decision.
Our time is running very short, but do you think one upside of all of these debates is that more people will pay attention to the Constitution and its role in North Carolina government?
I've oftentimes raised the flag at various of efforts to try to kind of wave the flag and say, look, state constitutions, they don't get anywhere near the attention the U.S. Constitution does, and yet they're important in their own rights. They grant rights sometimes that are in addition to the rights that you're granted under the U.S. Constitution. They, of course, set up all kinds of institutions that are different from the U.S. Constitution. So if one consequence of some of these recent court decisions is to turn people and interest people in the state constitution, that would be a good thing.
That is the voice of John Dinan, professor in the Department of Politics and International Affairs at Wake Forest University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina's junior U.S. Senator Tom Tillis is raising concerns about the long, drawn-out process of replacing military equipment. Tillis carries a prop with him. It's the official request for proposals for what's called the Next Generation Handgun.
It's almost 700 pages. Now, I want to talk a little bit about why I think this is making our men and women on the battlefield less lethal, less prepared, less capable than they should be. When you start a program in the Air Force in 2008, then you decide with DOD that it should be the next generation handgun. Then you let from 2008 to 2017 transpire, you create a nearly 700-page RFP, and we haven't even down-selected the suppliers yet. And we're supposed to replace the last generation handguns by 2020. Frankly, I think we should be replacing them sooner than that if it makes our soldiers safer and more lethal on the battlefield. This is a great testament to what's wrong with defense acquisition. And this is not about counting beans. This is about saving lives. And this is about killing the enemy. This is what we've got to fix. So I'm not going to get you into the details except to say, here's a mentality in the DOD that's got to get fixed too. When I had my staff, because I wanted the exact number, so I had my staff tell me what the exact page count. This is 680 pages. Now, interestingly enough, they'll probably come back and say, well, it's only 340 because you printed out in single on single page, not double-sided. Because they already came back and said that there's only 39 pages of technical specs. Well, if there's 39 pages of technical specs, what is all this other garbage in this document? Because that's the stuff that's preventing us from getting a more lethal, more reliable, more effective weapon on the battlefield. I'm going to keep on pounding on this thing. I could not possibly imagine what your the capabilities you bring in terms of recommending to us how we need to fight wars and take the fight to the enemy on the battlefield. But I do know business, and I do know that the business of the DOD has to change, and it needs to start with this kind of stuff. I just want to keep on pounding this. I'm going to bring my prop here so that we all get it right. 680 pages, 9 years, and we're not even in down selection. So it's 10 years plus, a decade for a pistol. I can break down and put together my 40 caliber pistol pretty easily with a blindfold on. In other words, they're relatively simple devices. I know that we have special applications for special operations, et cetera. That can be dealt with. But this one-size-fits-all, it's okay to go 9 or 10 years to get a new lethal weapon, has to stop.
That's North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis raising concerns about the time and money needed to replace a basic U.S. military handgun. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A 2016 attack at Ohio State University turned a spotlight on college campus safety. It's an issue familiar to the University of North Carolina. UNC Associate Vice President Brent Herron reminded lawmakers of this state's recent history.
2006, an individual by the name of Tahari Azar drove a vehicle into the pit at UNC Chapel Hill's campus, injuring 9. He was subsequently arrested, charged. He's currently doing a 33-year sentence for 2 counts of attempted murder. September of 2013, North Carolina Central police officers encountered an individual on their campus that was wanted by the Durham PD for armed robbery. When they approached the individual, he opened fire on them. There was a gunfire exchange. He was subsequently shot and killed by the campus police officers.
Herron says UNC campuses have made preparations.
All of our campuses do have an active shooter plan. We do have multiple ways of notification. We are required by the Clery Act to do this. We use our notification systems on a very regular basis. All of our campus police officers go through the exact same training as any municipal officers do as it relates to rapid deployment training. A lot was written about Ohio State, the training they do. We use the exact same training they do, shots fired, or the Department of Homeland Security Run, Hide, Fight are the two programs. We pretty much teach our students, faculty, staff. The three premises are if you can run, run. If you can't run, hide. We tell people what they should do if they need to barricade themselves in a room. And quite frankly, the one that I think was emphasized a little bit in the writings after Ohio State was the fight part. So we have to teach people that you can't be a lamb if somebody comes into the room. I mean, if it's a life and death situation, you're going to have to fight, and you're going to have to fight like this is the last thing left to do.
Members of the legislature's Emergency Management Oversight Committee had questions about UNC's plans. Senator Norman Sanderson.
Could you briefly tell us the most effective way or just basically how you communicate threats to your students and to your faculty?
Multiple ways, quite frankly, but if a student comes to our attention and we feel like that student could be deemed a threat to themselves or whatever, if it's an imminent threat and we feel like it's an imminent threat, i.e. being a person that could be on campus with a gun or whatever, we send an emergency notification out, and that's done through text messaging, emails, you know, the whole gamut. We're required to do that by Cleary, but we also do it the right way. If it's an individual that has come to our attention and we don't feel like it's an imminent danger at that point in time, then we will bring together our campus threat assessment teams, which are made up of various groups, and it's sort of up to that team to make a decision on what and how they're going to deal with it, to include involuntary evaluation if that's the case, which we have done before, to a voluntary withdrawal on a campus if the individual is a threat to themselves, and then monitoring as a result of, after which the threat assessment teams have to do some type of case management with that.
State Representative Michael Speciale had a question about guns on public college campuses.
Do you know what the general feeling is towards maybe staff and faculty carrying concealed on campus?
Well, I can tell you what we were on record of a couple of years ago when this when a law was passed allowing weapons on to be in a car, locked in a glove compartment, all myself included with the 16 police chiefs. We basically came and our stance was that we didn't feel like there was a need to have additional weapons on the campus. And primarily, Representative, it was a safety issue of if there was a shooter on campus. Our major concern is if we're responding to an individual that may have a gun, we don't know who that person is, and now we have two or three people on our campus with guns that may be good people. If they're encountered by our police officers and they don't obey the police officer's commands, then we're worried that somebody innocent individual could be harmed. And that, and in all honesty, I think that was one of our major concerns. And I think that's sort of a premise across the United States with most chiefs of police and most police officers.
That answer prompted a response from Republican Representative Larry Pittman.
I understand your concern.
Yes, sir.
I think you are sincere, and that's a legitimate concern. But you did say something about one component of response being to fight.
Right.
It's hard to fight a person with a gun if you don't have one. And I just believe, for instance, Sandy Hook Elementary.
Sure.
That brave principal charged that guy and was shot down. If she could have stood still and taken careful aim, she could have taken him out.
Right.
And I believe that anyone who qualifies to have concealed carry should be allowed to carry just for that reason, because by the time the police get there, a lot of times it's too late. Somebody could have already stopped the guy. Might be, unfortunately, somebody who is legitimately carrying a gun and trying to defend others might be mistaken by police as a perpetrator, and you know, that's a possibility. I understand that.
Sure.
But I think most people who have that training, you know, wouldn't understand that when the police officer says put the gun down, you put the gun down. So I understand your concern, but my interest or my feeling is that honest citizens need to be able to defend themselves, and where they're not able to, these things keep happening.
Senator Ronald Rabin co-chairs the Emergency Management Oversight Group.
You said you would want all students to have the training, and that's sort of a concern to me because I think we should make it that all students do get the training somehow. How much cooperation do you get from the UNC staff and faculty to get students to take the training so they know what the heck is going on and what to do? And how, you know, is there resistance in there? How do we, or can we fix it? And I have a feeling that if it's up to the student, there ain't probably very much interest in all of this,
right,
until the bad thing happens, and then why didn't I know?
It is voluntary, and we do put the message out. I tell you, my theory on this is if we had a person come into a room and we have 10 students or 20 students and at least two of those students, to include a faculty member, have gone through that training, that one or two people are going to take charge of that room and at least tell people what to do. So I know we're not going to get 100% on that, but if we could get a certain percentage and at least have make sure we've got one or two or three people trained up to do it, then that's one of the messages. And the answer to your question, unless it's required on each campus, then I don't know how we're going to do any better job than we're trying to do right now.
What about mandatory training? Rabin asked for an expert assessment.
In your opinion, should it be a required training class to increase survivability and increase the, you know, the chances that bad things won't happen to more people, or should it be left voluntary?
My personal opinion is it should be required.
Okay. I tend to agree with you, by the way.
Rabin also wants to know whether UNC campuses take steps to learn whether prospective students are members of terrorist watch lists.
Is there a system in place where when students enroll, there's a way to check names against watch lists around to see ahead of time if you got some folks in there that you might want to watch? Is that done rather than wait until something happens?
Short answer to your question is no, we don't have that. Other question is, if somebody does come to our attention and they're on our radar screen, then we're going to keep them on our radar screen. But we don't have that right now.
Not your watch list, but on other watch lists that are there, is there a way to, would it be a good idea to bounce the names against that to see ahead of time if you have folks coming in who have the potential for being bad guys because they're on other watch lists? By way of intel coordination is what I'm talking about.
I think I'd rather sit back and think about how we could approach that, and I'm certainly not going to say that. I think it's a viable question to take a look at. I don't have the answer to that question right now, sir.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent legislative discussion about safety measures on University of North Carolina campuses. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina should ensure that innocent people are not charged, prosecuted, and convicted for conduct that they could not reasonably be expected to know is actually wrong. That is the key conclusion of a new John Locke Foundation Spotlight report written by my next guest, John Guzet, who is Director of Legal Studies. Now, John has some recommendations for lawmakers to address a really fascinating issue that doesn't get a whole lot of news media coverage. That's why we're talking about it today. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
So when we talk about the criminal code, and we're going to be getting into this here when we look at your report, most people might be thinking, okay, criminal code, that's like robbery or murder or, heaven forbid, rape. But when you talk about the criminal code in North Carolina needing to do some reform, you're not talking about those types of crimes.
Well, not just about those types of crimes. We've seen just an almost unbelievable explosion in the number and the range of criminal offenses in North Carolina over the last 100 years. In fact, mostly over the last 50 years. Every year there's dozens of new crimes created, and most of them aren't anything like the traditional common law crimes of rape or murder or larceny. These are regulatory crimes. They're not things that people do that are crimes because they're evil, inherently evil. They're not crimes because they cause some harm to an identifiable victim. They're crimes simply because the legislature in its wisdom, or perhaps not even the legislature, but some regulatory agency or professional licensing board has decided that they don't want people doing these things simply because society will function better if people don't.
Give us an example of some type of regulatory crime that someone could actually commit and not even realize it.
Well, an example I like to use is the sale of speleothems. I don't suppose one person in 1,000 even knows what a speleothem is.
I don't.
But it's a mineral deposit found in a cave. Well, in North Carolina, if you sell one of those, or even if you transport one out of state with the intention of selling one, you've committed a misdemeanor, even if you found it on a cave on your own property.
Pretty amazing. So you are taking a look at this issue. Why, John?
It's part of a big problem that we've been dealing with for several years here at the John Locke Foundation. We call it overcriminalization. There's too many criminal laws, and making matters worse, they're not accessible to the general public. Some of them are in the Chapter 14 of the General Statutes, which is meant to deal with the criminal law, but hundreds of them are scattered all through the other over 140 other sections of the general statutes have criminal offenses defined in them, and that isn't even the end of it. There are many catch-all provisions in the statutes which criminalize violating rules and regulations that are created by not by the legislature, but by administrative agencies, by professional licensing boards, by municipalities, even by metropolitan sewer districts. These regulations aren't even in the general statutes. You have to go elsewhere. You have to look at the administrative code or perhaps some metropolitan statutory code. They're all over the place. There's no way an ordinary citizen can possibly know what is and isn't legal.
John, I've always heard, though, and maybe this is just, you know, an urban myth, but I've always thought that if you are ignorant of the law, that's really no excuse if you break a law.
Well, that's true, Donna. That's one of the oldest principles of our legal system. But that's not entirely – in fact, it's not the specific thing we're focusing on here, because the question here isn't whether or not you're ignorant of the law. The question is whether you knew any of the facts that had to do with what you did. Let's go back to that case about sale of speleothems. You might – as the law is written, there's nothing there – in the way of what we call mens rea. Mens rea is Latin for guilty mind. It used to be the case for centuries that you couldn't be convicted of a crime unless the prosecution could prove first that you committed an unlawful act and secondly that you did so with a guilty mind. That's what was necessary in order to prove culpability. Many, in fact, most of these new laws, there's no mens rea provision in the statute. So in the case of sale of speleothems, it doesn't matter whether you – it's not just a question of whether you knew that selling these mineral deposits from caves was illegal. You don't even have to know they were mineral deposits from caves. You might just find a pretty rock or someone might have given it to you, and if you turn around and sell it, you've committed a crime. That's not right.
Why was that guilty mind aspect left out of these laws that relate to regulatory issues?
Well, it was part of a huge transformation that took place at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century when people in the progressive movement started pushing to transform this country into a modern, what they considered to be a modern regulatory state. This meant transforming the criminal law from what it used to be, which was an instrument for punishing wrongdoers, into an instrument for social control. They wanted to use the criminal law as a tool for social engineering.
It sounds as if you're saying that they wanted to make examples of people.
That's precisely right. You know, another old principle of English American law is that we would prefer for 10 guilty men to go free rather than that one innocent person should be unjustly convicted. That's been turned on its head now. The attitude with the regulatory regime is that we don't mind punishing a few innocent people as long as it sets an example and persuades everybody else to comply.
Now, you write in your report on this issue that that's really unfair, that that's unjust, and you make some recommendations. Let's go over them. First of all, you say that we need a comprehensive review and update of the code.
Right. I think the best and most effective way to deal with not just the problem of mens rea, but the entire problem of overcriminalization is to completely review the entire body of criminal law in North Carolina. That means going through all the statutes, not just Chapter 14, looking at each, and it means going through all the regulatory codes that are out there as well, and finding each and every instance where some offense is classified as a crime. The legislature, or actually this will be done by a commission if it happens, and then will be approved by the legislature, but the commission needs to look at each of these things and decide, should this really rise to the level of a crime, or should it just be an infraction? If it is a crime, the definition needs to be complete in the sense that it has to specify what level of mens rea is required in order for prosecutions to succeed in finding of guilt. Or if it really is worth it, they can decide that this will be a strict liability crime for which there's no mens rea requirement, but I suspect that will be very seldom.
Would that also, that review also involve taking all of those things that are just spread out in all these different administrative codes and putting them all in one place?
Yes, that's in many ways the most important part to make this whole system work with some modicum of justice. We need to have one comprehensive criminal code that a citizen can go to and say, this is what I need to do. If it's well organized, if it's written in clear, accessible language, if all the elements of each crime are spelled out, including mens rea, then at least citizens have a chance, a reasonable chance, to know what is and what is not illegal.
Now, you also say that we should be going to a standard of a default mens rea requirement. Explain.
This would be something that we would add after recodification, or perhaps as part of the process. It would say that any new criminal laws that are created subsequent to recodification would either have to say explicitly what the mens rea level is, or if nothing was said, then there would be an implicit one, and the statute would spell out what minimal level of mens rea is required for conviction.
And lastly, John, very quickly, a mistake of law defense.
This goes back to what we talked about earlier. It is traditional to say that mistake of law is no defense, but I don't think that applies anymore under the conditions we've been dealing with lately. There's too many laws and nobody can possibly know them. That will be solved with recodification temporarily, but this kind of a provision would ensure that it won't come up again in the future.
John Guzet is Director of Legal Studies for the John Locke Foundation, and this report, you can read it at johnlocke.org. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.